Kuthethwa ngokugula apha uyaqonda uyabona ngoku uyaqonda uba ndithetha ngokugula uba wayebegula enjani uyaqonda ewe ubegula enganyangeki ngesilungu konke nje nenganyangeki abangangeniswa ezinkonzweni abangangena ngapha kalungi uyaqonda ewe uyagula uyaqonda ewe kuthiwe ke ngoku xana sebeyithetha ke ngoku kakuhle kuthiwe no lo mntu unengulo yesixhosa uyaqonda uyagula ugulela ugula ngesixhosa akanawunyangwa wakhe uyawunyangwa esixhoseni isintu
Umafungwashe ekhaya xa kusenza umsebenzi kufuneka mnibe ndima okuqala obetha imbobo. Umafungwashe intombazana yokuqala. So yiyo ke ndifunayo sokuthi izinto ezininzi zibetha kuye before sobetha kwabanye abasemva kwakhe. Hayi.
A few years ago, I found myself in a small village in the Eastern Cape. Abapanti had sent me there to document an ancestral ceremony of someone who, in time, came to be like a spiritual sister to me. After spending years photographically documenting ancestral ceremonies, experiencing one right in the heart of Ezilalini became a life-changing moment for me. What really struck me was the level of involvement that the community had in the whole process. In most townships, when there's a Sangoma ceremony somewhere, people around the neighborhood usually come to watch, mostly out of curiosity. It's like a spectacle. But here, in the vastness of the homeland, the community didn't come to be spectators. They came to be an integral part of the ceremony. I mean, for one thing, virtually everyone knew all the songs that were being sung. In fact, many people knew the actual drumming patterns that were needed for the different songs. Looking back at that moment, I started reflecting on all the information that I spoke about in episode 2. The intense changes that colonialism, religion, and natural disasters brought about impacted the cultural psyche of Black people. The migrant labor system that started around the early 1900s forced many Black men out of their homes and fed them into the pits of the gold mining industry. Many Black women were left behind to face much of the devastation on their own. Some of them found refuge in the church. The Women's Manyano organization was founded as a mechanism of integrating Christian and by extension Western virtues into Black society. But it also allowed Black women to create new ways of redefining themselves and new ways of caring for their families under the oppressive system that they were living under. As the industrial machinery of the 1920s rumbled on, many women began to leave their villages for the mining towns. Some went to join their husbands, but some also went of their own accord to try to make a living. During that time, there was no sector that was willing to employ women, much less so black women. But there were hundreds of white families that needed nannies and cleaners and gardeners. And the domestic and gardener environment, being perceived as a Christian, was basically like having a great CV. Having been educated at a missionary school was akin to having a degree. This is because at the time, white people believed that a black person who was Christian had been taught essentially to be subservient to white people. Black women who worked in Makishini generally lived in the maid's quarters of the employer's premises. These women generally worked far from their homes and their families, and they basically worked 6 to 7 days a week. Over time, however, the white madams began to informally give their helpers days off on Thursdays, which was also in line to what the church had taught, that women needed to spend time in devotional services and learning more skills. This day came to be called Sheila's Day. On this day, many women could attend to their own personal matters. They could run errands or catch up with friends. For many women who were members of Women's Manyano, even those who didn't live with their employers, this was the only time they could attend to their organizational duties. This is a part of how Thursday came to be the day of Imitandazo. Reflecting on the time that I spent in the village, I started thinking about the transition that black women in particular went through. The transition from emakhaya to the newly developing urban areas and townships. But not just the geographic transition, but the temporal transition, like the transition through time, because they were not only leaving one place for another, they were also moving from one era into another. I also wanted to understand the generational transition, the one from our great grandmothers, our grandmothers, our mothers, and right up until our sisters, our partners, and our friends today. I wanted to know what was the impact of the spiritual displacement that happened during this time. What did they leave behind? How did this move change women's relationship with religion, spirituality, each other, and their relationship with themselves? To get some insights on this perspective, I went to have a chat with the person whose ceremony it was that I was attending, Vangile Gancho. Vangile Gancho is a poet, a healer, and co-founder of Impepo Press. She's unapologetically a black woman, and she has traveled the continent and the globe participating in literary events and festivals. She's also the author of two poetry collections, Undressing in Front of the Mirror, published in 2015, and Red Cotton in 2018. She holds an MA from the university currently known as Rhodes, and she was recently named one of Mail and Guardian's top young 200 South Africans of 2018. She's also the mother of baby Levo, who is herself an accomplished owner of the cutest button nose you've ever seen. She also shared some of her thoughts on the topic too. Women's Manyano, from my understanding, it functions on women's ability to come together. Mm. Manyano means unity, you know, and women have been coming together. Mm. And I think from my view, standing from the outside looking in, it's that the church was giving them that. Is that part of the thing that they yearned for when they arrived in urban areas? The connecting to other women,
I would imagine so, because first of all, because we're a communal people by nature. Mm-hmm. But then, second of all, if you're displaced and you come to this place, you think about how our mothers came to these places. It was always uzukhangele usbanbani. Mm. Usbanbani will take care of you. And then Usbanbani had gotten there first. And so Usbanbani had already created a network of people. And so the network of people is people who are like-minded or people who are all from the same similar places. Do you understand? Mm. And so it would make sense that you then pray together, you then commune together, like as in, because you have shared experiences, and this is how you bring home with you. You carry home with you into this foreign place.
It almost seems like the church latched onto that.
Yeah. You know, the thing about the church and government, it's not unheard of that the church would identify people who have kind of leadership qualities and have them be the ones doing the work for them. Does that make sense? And so if they say, okay, jonga nangu vangile, uvangile siyamazba ngumuntu othetha kakhulu, ngumuntu okwazi uzisa abantu. So we have to get uvangile to believe, and then she must be the one who's going to go and convert people, because they're not going to listen to us, but they will listen to uvangile. And that happened a lot. There are many examples of that where all you have to do is recruit one person, and then that person will do the recruiting for you. So I think the church definitely latched on to the idea of community, and that thing of, if I don't know anyone and I only know you, then I'm going to trust you and I'm going to feel safe with you. And then I'm going to go with you to your church, because, you know, otherwise I'm sitting here alone anyway. And then when I get to your church, I'm going to feel at home. And so I'm going to come, and I'll come alone next time. And then after that, I'll actually bring someone else who I've met and say, listen, you know, I actually just started going to this church. That's how recruitment works. I mean, you know.
So now women were arriving in the Transvaal, in your Joburg, and they had moved from the reserve. Now they were in the urban areas, the townships were being built. How was their identity evolving? Because now they weren't in that whole thing of, you know, the traditional work that they used to do, the traditional work that they could identify with. You know, we are women, this is what we do. They couldn't do that here. There are no farms, there are no, you know, homesteads. It's these little box houses, if you were lucky. How are women now learning to define, you know, how are they finding themselves again?
All stories I've heard have kind of spoken to how women have replicated that. I mean, so we think of it as traditional work, but it's actually just regular work, right? So you go from how do you manage, how do you take care of your homestead, to how do you then provide for your homestead as a person who knows how to take care of a homestead. You go and you take care of someone else's homestead and get money for it. And if you can't go and usebenze makichini okanye usebenzele umadam, you're going to find something that you can sell. You know, if you can sew, you will sew and you will sell that. If you can buy things, you will buy things and you will sell that. And so, like, just across the board, black women know how to clean and black women know how to sell. And they have done that as a way of keeping their families fed.
I'm trying to figure out how much of their traditional identity is still around. How are women different now than they were back then, in terms of, you know, because women, from my understanding in the talk that I had with my mother, women identified themselves as mothers. You know, that was like your identity. And then when the church came, then you identified, you were a mother, and then you were, you know, umama umthandazo. What about the actual person? Where did the person go in that? Where does a person's actual personality reside? Because it's easier now to, you know, with this generation, because women are sort of coming into their own and they're less identified with their physiology and say, you know, I'm a woman and that's my primary identity, or because I'm a woman, my job will be a mother and that's what I identify with, you know. It shows that there's a wider spectrum to a person, but if those identities do not exist, you know, like...
You know, I think there is merit in Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
Because self-actualization is something that you need to have time for.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to have time for it, you need to have money or some kind of resources so that your primary needs are met.
Mm.
And so I imagine that if you are leading the kind of life where you don't have to worry about where the food is going to be coming from, where the safety of your children is going to, like whether your children are going to be safe, then you can think about things like, who am I as a person?
Mm.
What am I interested in? But the reality is, migration was not a choice. It was a need. And it was a response to the political and socioeconomic climate. And it resulted in Black women having to make it work all the time. So you're balancing having to provide for your family and also having to take care of your family. You have to raise your children. You have to, and so, like, I have conversations with my mother all the time where she's like, Ninela kiyazi, Nina, because, like, when I was pregnant, she would say to me, hey, akumnanduba pregnant in these days, because you can think about, oh, my baby is moving and I think my baby has a personality and all those. I never had time to think about things like that. I never had time. Do you understand what I mean? I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I'm saying that Black women have been tired for a long time because they've been busy.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been busy because they've had to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's now that our mothers have afforded us the luxury of finally deciding who we want to be. Like, Umama says to me all the time about, hey, and the Azle generation, happiness is so important to them. But what makes you happy? Tinazange is clinging to us, jalo. It was, you know, I've been working since the age of 18. I've had to provide. If I go to school, I'm going to school so that my siblings can also go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I have to take care of my siblings. I have to take care of my children. I was too busy to think about being happy, what makes me happy.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
And I'm assuming that her mother was even in a worse off situation than she was, because the whole thing about working was also...
Funny enough, I think that part yes and part no. Because Umama tells me about Utamkhulu wakhe, who before the trusts, you know, the trusts and in the Eastern Cape and started dividing land, because, you know, you, as a Black person, you couldn't own too much land.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, Umama remembers a time where Utamkhulu wakhe, before, when they had lots and lots of land, we all had ikomiti yethu, and we would, I mean, not ikomiti, ipainti yethu, and we would, and we would get fresh milk from the cow, and we would sit and sibalisele izitori, you know, like as in intsomi, and like how good life was, like as in. And so Mama ka Mama's family was relatively wealthy until the trusts came and took their land.
Wow.
And so the wealth was attributed to the land, because the land provided for them. And so they grew tobacco, they grew other things
Wow,
that they were able to trade. But also, like, as in things that they were able to live off. And so they didn't need to go in to a Dolopini to buy things. They could make things for themselves. They could grow things for themselves. And so they were wealthy. Do you understand? And so the dispossession of Black people is very tied to this, to land, not in a very kind of esoteric way, but in a very real practical way. Of the land was provision. And so if you don't have to worry about what you're going to eat, and you don't have to worry about what you're going to wear, because you can make clothes. I mean, fabrics were woven. Do you understand? So poverty is poverty comes with capitalism, with racism, and so I imagine that, you know, Black women were afforded personalities before we trust.
Wow. So that means that it puts our generation of mothers in a very particular history, because then they went from all of that land wealth, you know, in whatever form it came, you know, be it livestock or, you know, planting. But now, then they had to move to here, to the urban areas. And in urban areas, there was already this shifting happening. So I feel like they had to bear a lot in the direction that our lives ended up taking. In that they were the middle. They actually went through more changes than we think we have. You know, if we look at, okay, our biggest change that we can say we went through would be like 94. You know, when politically apartheid ended, you know, and there was a change in government. But more than anything, there's been, you know, they went through proper displacement more than we have, you know, because we can still relatively stay in the same place for much longer, whereas they had to see their land shrink. Then to the extent where they couldn't live on the land anymore, or they were forced off the land. And then they come to the mining towns, and then they're forced to live in a certain... Then they're also moved again from there.
I think more than our mothers, it was our grandmothers, right? Because umama talks about it as umzukulwan, kumbula utamkhulu wakhe. And so so what must that have meant for umama kamama, who had to go from growing up being like coming from a family that didn't want for anything, to then having to go and work in my kitchen so that she can put her children through school. You know what I mean? And so those two particular generations, our grandmothers and our mothers, I think, but also I try to steer clear of who's experienced more shifts than who. Like, as in, I don't like to compare, yabo, because every generation comes with its own weight. But that was a hell of a transition. To go from being free people to people who are displaced for no reason, and reasons that you don't understand. Because mama will say things like, everybody used to ask, but he trusted ten, like as in who, how do they just come? And obviously there were areas where they couldn't, the trust couldn't cut up the land, because the people just were like, no, you have no authority. But once things like guns are involved, and you know, it's an unfair fight, everything operates on multiple levels. And so, for example, Omama did a fantastic job in buffering the kind of the physical hardships as much as they could of what was happening, like as in buffering, like protecting us as much as they could. But also there was a there was a psychological imprint that they weren't aware of because they had to stay low and keep firing. We talk about men who fought against apartheid and who were fighting against the political system as if the women weren't keeping the houses afloat, the homes afloat, too, as if they weren't making sure that, because these men had children, what happens to those children? But also, where do these men go home to? You know? And so, Mama would say to me always, because my dad was a freedom fighter, and Mama was like, "Besingazukwazi uzabalaza sobabini. Omnye wethu funeka ahlale ajonge abantwana. Like, sizawuthini, abantwana bethu sizabathini if sizawuzabalaza sobabini." And it doesn't mean uba naye wayengazabalazi. Wayezabalaza in a different way. And so that role also gets diminished so much. But what does it mean for a woman to take a newborn baby and hide papers in between herself and her newborn baby and then walk around trying to transport these papers, or have to go and find your husband where you don't know where he was? He was last seen here. He could be arrested. He could be killed. He could be... Do you understand?
Mm.
So not only are you taking care of your children, but you're also taking care of your husband in that way, in that sense. And I say this because, like, as in to highlight the many layers, and what does it then mean for children who grow up without fathers, but also children who grow up with nervous mothers, you know, or angry
nervous
mothers.
Nervous mothers, in your understanding.
Nervous mothers who are aware that their doors can be broken down at any minute.
Mm.
And these people aren't going to knock, knock, hello, sorry, we're looking for so-and-so. They barge in, they tear everything down, and then they leave. And you have to, you know, deal with your scared children, but also you have to salvage what you can, build your house up again, and know that at any minute they could come back again.
Mm.
You know?
Sure. One of the things that healers in my generation, not even just healers, people who sort of consider themselves people who practice African spirituality, they would always say that their biggest challenge in engaging with this form of belief is that my mother is Christian. She doesn't like this,
mm-hmm.
or she doesn't believe in this. You know, in a way, similar to my story.
Mm-hmm.
And now, the more I think about it, it's like being a healer is also a very demanding job,
mm-hmm.
and you know, because there's this whole story of, you know, my grandmother ran away to the church, or my mother ran away to the church. And now when I listen to you, I'm like, what choice did they have?
Mm.
You know, what could they do?
Mm.
With because people now are in a panic about, they're told by they have to go by Otoasa, they don't have money, they don't have, you know what I mean? There's lots of things that they don't have. But back then they also didn't have those. In a more, even more severe case of it, because I mean, basic things like transportation, you know, we take it for granted that we can pretty much get to most places now, whereas back then you had to find, getting, not a lot of people had cars and transportation, and you know, it would have been so much more demanding.
So, what, for Uktwasa?
Yeah, all the logistics of it.
Of Uktwasa?
Yeah.
I think it's because you're imagining Uktwasa then the way it is.
This is precisely now. It. Because now I'm trying to figure out what was their reality. Like, how was that process like back then compared to now? Because I actually don't know what Uktwasa involved back then. Whereas right now, it costs 50,000 rand. It costs... You know,
so I don't, first of all, there isn't a monolith on Uktwasa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no one way to Uktwasa. Zininzindlela zokuthwasa, and for different purposes, right? But also, ngokwazi kwam ngokugula nokufundiswa nokunyangwa, I know that any type of health is not reserved for those with money. Umuntu can't turn you away because awunamali. And so there were other ways. So you weren't trading in imali. You weren't ubungakhanyisa ngemali. Ubukhanyisa ngalento unayo. And ukhanyisa ukuhlonipha isihlwele. So lonto unayo isihlwele sakho siza kubona. Sibone uba uzisa lonto unayo and si samkele lonto. It has become a money-making thing. It has become a monetary, because that's also, I mean, and this is not to say that money isn't important. Money is important because healers also need to be able to pay for their livelihoods. And so the currency has changed. But when you can't imagine ukthwasa outside a monetary system, whereas ukthwasa has existed long before imali. And ukthwasa also, in existing long before imali, also took longer than uyohlalisa 3 months pa, okanye 6 months pa. Umntana wethongo wayebonwa esemncinci, akhule kind of as an apprentice or emanesiya kogogo. Do you understand? So uqala uthwasa usengumntana. Ukhule ufunda uyazi ba mna ndingumntana wethongo kufuneka ndiziphathe kanje nakanje nakanje. These are the things that I will learn, and it, because it's a lifelong process, so that by the time you come of age there isn't even a set time of coming to age. Umntana ona 9 could be igqirha elipheleleyo depending on ithongo lakhe uba lisebenza kanjani. Do you understand? And so I think that we need to be careful when we think about it, about ukthwasa, not to think of it just as how it's taking place now, where pretty much kind of like churches, it has to be housed somewhere, or an offering, a monetary offering must then be made, as opposed to. And all, you know how you keep saying about you can't separate African spirituality. Akwazi ukuthi iqala apha iphele pha. Nokuthwasa awangakwazi ukuthi ndithwasa apha andithwasi pha. Do you understand? Mna kuzawuthwa like ndizobheka, I mean ndizoya ephehlweni ngoku ndimdala. Kodwa when I talk about my life and things that were happening, athi mama, uyazibona uba wawuthwasa pha. When I was doing this, like as in, oh, when I stopped eating meat for 2 years for no reason. Yes, bonba wa utwas, when I started to pinga skaf, and ditwale for no reason. When I couldn't leave the house without something around my head. Yes, bonba wa utwasapa. Yes, bonba kutala wa utwasapangi. You understand? Where your ancestors will find the way to teach you the things you need to learn. With or without money.
So then, is it a accurate assumption then to say, in the moving, in the migration, that is the key information that was lost? Absolutely. Along in that, when people then arrived in the urban areas, the people who had this knowledge were left back. Emakhaya.
Absolutely. But also it starts before that, because when missionaries come and they teach your children, okay, so for whatever pragmatic reasons, you give them your children so that they can educate your children. And then they teach your children, and then your child comes home and says, no, mommy, it's not bird, it's bed. You know, or mama, why don't you speak English? You know. You know, you can't be all as like all that clever. So teacher is more clever than mama, because teacher can speak English and mama can't speak English. But then the idea where children would learn from their grandparents and from their parents is then broken, because of language, because intelligence is associated with language, and children can no longer trust the information they are getting from people who don't speak English. And so that has broken a communication, yabo, already. And then you leave the people who have this knowledge behind, and you create further displacement by adding geography to it. Does that make sense? And so I think yes, migration played a huge role, but it started long before that.
Over time, the functioning of women's manyano evolved, but it's still centered around community service. I believe that one of the main reasons why this organization has survived for over 100 years is because Black women had found a common ground between capitalism, cultural patriarchy, and religion. For capitalism, one of the most remarkable traits that women's manyano has is its ability to raise funds. No other organization within the church can marshal the raising of funds quite like Abomama Bomthandazo. Basically, the church could never get rid of Abomama because Abomama make the church a ton of money. Culturally, men have allowed their wives and daughters to participate within women's manyano because they came to understand that in the church, women were taught to be the very best wives, housekeepers, and mothers that they could be. Also, men knew that the brand of Christianity that women were being taught at the time meant that their wives would never come home from church one day and challenge the men's position within the home. In terms of religion, Abomama Bomthandazo are an army. In fact, the Methodist Church's manyano uniform was modeled against the uniform of Queen Victoria II's Royal Guard, which were black shoes, black pants, red jackets, and white hats. Abomama are an intensely devoted and selfless army, without which no church would be standing today in the township. When I was still doing research on Abomama Bomthandazo, I spent some time with my mother as she went about her women's manyano duties. One day, I went with her to a memorial service of one of the elderly ladies from her church. It was on a Thursday, naturally. I sat at the back of the church, and in front of me was a sea of multicolored manyano uniform from every denomination in the area. It was here that something happened that changed my whole view and understanding of Abomama Bomthandazo. As is the nature of memorial services, some of Abomama got up and shared kind words and fond memories of the lady who had passed, and then they would sing intermittently in between. The church was hot and the windows were slim, which didn't help much. As the singing intensified, I saw an elderly lady slump violently to one side, landing on the woman who was sitting next to her. The singing didn't stop though. Very few people paid much notice. The lady who had to catch the one who had fallen over waved another lady over, and the two of them carried the one who was struggling to the outside of the church. As they walked past me, I could tell that the lady hadn't collapsed from heat exhaustion, nor was she taken by her grief over the death of her friend. This lady, an elder woman, probably well into her 60s, was in an ancestral trance. This wasn't just any kind of ancestral trance. It was the kind that happens to people who have never learned how to be in sync with Idlozi. People who have never been to a pehlweni. After a few minutes, another lady disappeared down into the rows of uniforms, and she too was carried out. Same symptoms. At some point, there was a lady dressed in blue and white uniform who was standing in the front. She was deep in the throes of an intense prayer when she froze as the telltale signs of Idlozi began to reverberate through her. One lady shouted, "Mbambeni uzowa," and two ladies jumped up and ushered her to the outside. Yet, this wasn't even the most shocking part. As the third lady was carried out, I decided to step outside because I could no longer handle the heat in the church. And what I found outside shook me to the core. The first lady who had been carried out had now recovered and she was standing on her own drinking a bottle of water. The last lady to be carried out was still struggling. The two women who had carried her out were administering the exact same remedies that Abu Gobel administered to an uninitiated person who falls into trance at a Sangoma ceremony. The exact same remedies. But this was a church. A Christian church packed full of abomama bomthandazo. Not only were some of them falling into ancestral trances, but no one seemed surprised by this. Not only were they not surprised, they knew exactly what to do to help. We are all familiar with the narrative of the woman who had a calling and ran away to the church. There are many young women today who have been told that the reason they have a calling or the reason why their calling is manifesting in a destructive way in their lives is because their grandmother ran away from her calling. Now, here I was in a church full of grandmothers, some of whom had ran away from their calling. And here they were, falling into ancestral trance, right in the middle of the church. And in that very church, they were being helped using ancestral remedies. It was in that moment that I realized that these women hadn't run away from their calling. There's nowhere really for a black woman to run to in this country. I started to look back at all the research that I had done and all that I had learned, and a heavy question entered my mind. What were they supposed to do? Your grandmother, your great-grandmother, what was she supposed to do? It was the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s. The trauma of oppression was not a distant past. It was the very air that they breathed. Much worse was still to come. I mean, apartheid hadn't even been invented yet. By the 1950s, unemployment amongst women was at around 90%. And that 10% who had jobs, mostly working as maids, they had to be Christian in order to get those jobs. She needed a Christian name for her white madams to feel comfortable with her existence, much more so her presence in their home. In 1957, the Witchcraft Suppression Act was passed and it deemed it illegal to be a sangoma. It was illegal to be a healer. It was a criminal offense. You could go to jail. What was she supposed to do? What more could she carry when she was already carrying her entire people on her breath? Your grandmother didn't run away from her calling. As Ugogo Mlondolozi once said, your calling never stops calling. Church doesn't cure idlozi. It never did, and it never will. There are those who ask for some reprieve from the ancestors. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. The rest, they took their calling to the church because there, they knew that they would find maybe someone who would help them carry the burden. Maybe they ran to the church for Jesus. Maybe there's something in the idea of a man willing to die for the sake of a woman. Can you imagine that? A man willing to die for the sake of a black woman. We can speculate religion all we want, but what is a solid and undeniable fact is that in the church, black women found each other. As I stood and watched as one mother after another succumbed to spirit, no one stood back in disgust. No one called out witch in scorn. Instead, they kept on singing. they carried each other in song. They carried each other in prayer. And when the load got too much, they carried each other by their bare hands and summoned the most ancient of their ancestors, because you don't pray someone out of an ancestral trance. Your grandmother took her calling to the church and turned everyone in the family against African beliefs because she hoped that in doing so, no child or grandchild of hers would have to carry such a burden. Your grandmother turned your mother against African beliefs because your grandmother knew that if she didn't turn her daughter against African beliefs, then her daughter stood absolutely no chance in this world. "Leave those things alone and go to church," your grandmother said to her daughter. And in her heart, she whispered, "Because you don't know what this world will do to you if you don't." Your mother did as she was told. Now Ugogo is back as Idlozi Lakho, and your mother doesn't believe you because that's not the mother that she knew. That is a matter between your mother and her mother. Honor your grandmother in the best way that you can under the circumstances that your life allows. Leave the rest. Maybe all you know is the brutality and abuse that came with a mother who was more devoted to the church than to her own children's emotional well-being. Maybe that pristine uniform inflicted wounds that cut right to your soul. Maybe it is a wound that has never healed because it is ripped open almost every day. I am sorry that this happened to you. I am deeply and sincerely sorry that this happened to you. Xolo mntana sekhaya. It was never, ever your fault. We can gather in our technological wokeness and the hindsight that history affords us and castigate our mothers and grandmothers, but I leave you with this. What will your great-grandchildren, what will your grandchildren say about you? What will their cry be to you? Thank you.